and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 18th, 2022. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we're bringing you an interview with longtime British Columbia politician Joy MacPhail. MacPhail is best known for her roles in BC politics, but there is much more to her story. Many will remember her as Deputy Premier of British Columbia. MacPhail is a longtime member of the BC NDP and member of the BC Legislative Assembly, representing Vancouver Hastings. Over her groundbreaking and at times controversial career that began in the BC labor movement before being elected to politics, she served as Minister of Finance, Minister of Education, Minister of Health, Minister of Social Services and Seniors, and more. Currently, MacPhail chairs the ICBC board, the Insurance Corporation of BC, and is an owner of OutTV, the world's longest airing LGBTQ+ television network. She was appointed to the Order of Canada this past January, where she was recognized for her pioneering contributions to politics and for her tireless advocacy of underserved and marginalized communities. MacPhail speaks to fellow politician and friend Libby Davies. Davies is also a lifelong political activist and politician, but at the municipal and federal levels. She was a longtime Vancouver City Councillor and former Deputy Leader and House Leader of the federal NDP, representing the riding Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015. Davies is also a member of the Order of Canada. MacPhail reflects on a lifetime of experiences as a woman in Canadian politics. She recounts the gender-based scrutiny she faced from the media and shares what it was like trying to balance being a mother while breaking ground for women in politics. She also discusses how she maintains motivation for positive change to this day. Here are Davies and MacPhail in conversation. Take a listen.
Joy, your recent appointment to the Order of Canada is a wonderful recognition of your outstanding public and community service. In other conversations on Rabble Radio, we've been exploring the challenges women and underrepresented groups face in the political arena. Now, when you look back on your political work over so many years and the key leadership roles you took on as minister of various portfolios, including finance, deputy premier, so many roles, what stands out as the biggest hurdles that you faced?
Youth, inexperience, lack of training in the position of governing. These are big public service jobs, and it's a great honor to hold any public service job, and particularly an elected job. And when I got elected, Libby, for the first time, and you participated in that victory, I had no training whatsoever. I barely knew what second reading meant in passing legislation. And then I got promoted to cabinet, and there was very little training except mentorship of my fellow colleagues in how to be a cabinet minister. And I'll tell you, the people who surrounded me in my appointment, my first appointment as cabinet, were the other women in cabinet. Darlene Marzari, Elizabeth Cull, Anne Edwards. And we would meet in the women's bathroom, and I'd go, oh my gosh, just help me through this, help me through this. And as we were putting on our lipstick to refresh before we went and talked to the media, they would help me. So it was lack of experience in the role of governing.
It's incredible that in such an important work area, there is no training. And I'm wondering, do you think that anything has changed today?
Yes, I do, because I participated in training for John Horgan's first cabinet back in 2017, when he appointed half women and half men to his cabinet. And he invited Gary Doer, former premier of Manitoba, and me to come in and do an afternoon of training. It was just an afternoon, but we offered follow-up with the new cabinet. And then both Gary and I gave our contacts, and after that, many had followed up. And I know that there's much more training for not only MLAs, but also people joining the cabinet.
What kind of advice or training did you provide to those new members, particularly women who, like you, were stepping up for the first time with virtually no resources or tools to help them?
I said that your family has to come first. Learn quickly on how to balance family responsibilities, which could include aging parents, or it could be children at home still, or it could be children at university that need a lot of extra support. I said, make sure you find out very quickly what the balance is, the fulcrum between your family and your job. Don't hesitate to speak out when you need support or time off. And also understand that these are big jobs that you have and that the demands are going to be big, both public and private. I also said that make sure that you have a support system in place in your constituency so that constituency work still remains high in your priorities. Because after all, Libby, without the support of our constituents, we're not there. Those were two of the pieces of advice. And I also said that cabinet collegiality is very important in the decision-making process. Don't ever think that you can go to the cabinet table without first getting at least some idea of where your cabinet colleagues are going on an issue that's of importance to you.
Mm-hmm. And what about the environment, both in the ledge, but also with the media or out in public? Do you feel that in those early days, particularly, you faced an environment where you were questioned because you were a woman, or you were doubted in terms of your ability? Because you held very high cabinet positions. You were finance minister, you were minister of health, you were minister of social services on different occasions, you were deputy premier. Did you ever feel that that double standard came into play and was a barrier that you had to deal with?
Well, I confess to not having a good memory on some of these issues, because I think people will tell me I've blocked out memories of harassment and a form of abuse that did rain down upon me. I've blocked those out. But I will tell you the period of time when it was very obvious that because we were two women, we were being treated badly. And that was when Jenny Kwan and I formed the entire opposition in the chamber, 77 liberals and two of us. And there's no other way to describe it. It was awful. How can I say that some of the sexism was, I'm sure that, for instance, the speaker of the day not permitting Jenny or me to have bathroom breaks would not consider that sexist. But of course it was. Jenny was pregnant at one point. And of course, you know, with all the two of us holding up legislation or holding the legislation to account, the minute one of us left, they would pass the legislation. So us being in the chamber was very important. There were often times when we were surrounded by liberals that they would make sexist comments. And frankly, I recall bigoted and racist comments as well, particularly targeted against Jenny Kwan, a Chinese-Canadian woman. So I remember those clearly. However, there were other times when there would be lots of commentary about my hairstyle. In the media, there would be lots of commentary about the color of my lipstick. And I know other women suffered from that as well. However, I think the biggest challenge I faced was being a parent and not having people understand how the pressure of being a parent, particularly in the media as well, could influence my day-to-day functioning.
I really know what you mean when you say you think you probably blocked out or erased some of those experiences, because that certainly was the case for me. And I really had to think about it. I really had to dive deep to remember all of those 1,001 microaggressions,
exactly.
Right? And yeah. How they pile up and they accumulate. And one hopes only that it is beginning to change and it is beginning to improve. But it was certainly a big issue, and it still is an issue today.
Well, Libby, I know we're one short, but, you know, you were a young mom very early on in your life, very young. And then I was in my late 30s when I had Jack. But, you know, the daycare situation was just awful. There was no daycare to accommodate our hours of work. And that's changed now, thank goodness. The hours of work for politicians has changed for the better to accommodate families.
Yeah, I remember public hearings at City Hall going till 3 a.m. in the morning because, ironically, Gordon Campbell, the same guy that you had to deal with as premier when he was the mayor of Vancouver, and it was just Bruce and I, again, two against them, he would refuse to adjourn the hearings because he wanted to, like, ram something through, right? And he knew that working people had to go home because they didn't have childcare and people would drop off the list. And so I think it really does speak to the political environment and how it can be toxic, not only for women, but for young parents who are caring for families. And you have to make these incredibly awful choices between your political work and your family responsibilities. And I don't think that's ever been fully understood. It's now being documented, and I think change is beginning. But I think those early days that you and I went through, each of us with a kid and trying to make those balances, it was tough, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much so, very much so. But we do see young babies being allowed on the legislature floor, both in Ottawa and in British Columbia, because the moms are doing direct care for them. So that's an improvement.
Now, I want to actually go back in time and remember that you began in East Vancouver, where we're both from, and it began with what I remember as quite a scrappy nomination meeting. I think it was 1991. And you don't have to dwell on the nomination meeting. That's all history. It's all public. But what I'm interested in, and what I think our listeners are interested in, is what stands out for you in these years of public service? What is it that you feel most proud of? Like, if we want to encourage women to run, if we want to encourage underrepresented groups, visible minorities, Indigenous candidates, LGBT community candidates, to think about what you were very proud of and stands out for you, I think it's very illuminating for us to know.
Yes, and it will. When I tell this story, it always comes as a surprise. People want to have me being the most proud of big, gigantic public issues. My greatest moment of pride was passing the brand new Adoption Act. It was the first Adoption Act completely revamped in North America, where we opened up records and set up a registry where the triangle of adoption — birth moms and dads, adoptive parents, and the adoptee — could find each other. It was we formalized the registration process. And it changed the world, I found out afterward, for people in that triangle of adoption, so that lives were changed. And that came about by intense community consultation, Libby, because we know that no government can make that revolutionary a change affecting so many lives without having all public input. And we ended up having agreement amongst the three partners in adoption. And we were the first government to allow same-sex couples to adopt. And, you know, that was early on in my career. That was in the mid-90s. And that is my proudest moment, because I still meet people, my friends, who revealed that they had to give up a child to adoption and that they were able to reunite through the new legislation. And then the other one that you'll love this, setting up TransLink, setting up the system for local governance of our public transit. Now, it got messed up later on by the Liberal government and changed it to not a community governance model. But TransLink, it's a great thing. And, you know, I worked on that with George Puel, the curmudgeonly city councillor. But hey, you can go along to get along, and with a goal in mind that's better public transit, anything can be achieved.
You know, winning and being successful in politics isn't necessarily an easy thing to do, even if you're part of a majority government, especially if you are part of a minority, you know, and you're sort of excluded from that old boys network. But the idea of you have to work with even your adversaries, right? Like the George Pules of the world, who we remember as a city councillor, and you had to deal with him on TransLink. But what advice would you offer to women and other underrepresented groups who want to run for political office?
One is pick a political party where how much money you have is not important, how much personal resources you have, financial resources. And now, hey, that turns out that's the NDP, the New Democratic Party, that convincing or informing underrepresented groups that it's not about fundraising, because so many underrepresented groups think that's what it's about, is that you have to bring your own resources to the table. With a strong political party, that is not the case. And secondly, start at a level that you feel most comfortable with. And for me, that was the community level, first and foremost, working on greening our local park, Hastings Park. Do something that you are totally comfortable and means something important to you, and build upon that.
Now, you're still very much in public service, Joy. You're the chair of the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, ICBC, as we call it. And often ICBC is in the news. It's a very public crown corporation. So you're the chair. You're the successful owner of OutTV, which is the longest airing LGBTQ plus television network, which is amazing. So question, what keeps you motivated and, if I could say, unretiring?
Well, I am retiring from some of my responsibilities this spring because I'm turning 70 next month. And I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of that. We're still going strong, Libby. Well, you're a baby compared to me.
Well, 1 year behind you.
And it's time to move the leadership of certain organizations, the governance, to younger people, to other women, people of minorities, minority representation. So I'm retiring after 5 years on the ICBC board in the end of June. But I'm so proud of what we've achieved at ICBC. We went from a $1.5 billion deficit in the Car Insurance Corporation to now a $1.5 billion surplus, and we've enhanced the care that everybody gets if and when they're in a car accident. So it's lifelong care that they get. It's just been wonderful. James, my husband, is the main conduit for OutTV. It's become a complex business, and he still revels in that our company there. But I am going to take on a couple of new responsibilities. Stay tuned. One is going to be very exciting, working with some Indigenous leadership in the Lower Mainland around housing issues. The great thing, Libby, is that when you're retired from day-to-day work, that you have flexibility to contribute more in areas that you love the most. It's a great pleasure it's a great honor to be able to do that. And I will just tell the for women thinking about going into politics, one of the great things that being a politician benefit is that you end up having a pension. Public service pension is the greatest thing to allow women to participate fully in their passions and not always worry about, you know, getting some horrendous salary, because at least politicians are honored with a good public service pension. And that allows me the flexibility that I don't have to work late in life just to look after myself.
I think that's an incredible point that you've made, Joy, and not many people recognize that public pension system actually helps foster and strengthen equity.
And exactly.
Very important for women.
Very much.
You know, I remember having a conversation with you a few years ago, and I remember you were so anxious and worried about the future in terms of the climate crisis and just where the world was headed. And if I remember correctly, it was maybe around the invasion of Iraq. It was around that time frame. And I just remember feeling your anxiety about how you were about the future of our world, our planet. And I just wonder, like, how do you maintain your motivation? You're a very upbeat person. You're a very positive person. I've always known you that way. How do you maintain that in today's world with, you know, the pandemic that continues on and all of these global things that keep unfolding? What keeps you going?
Well, the fact is that my generation has contributed greatly to the problems of the world. And I feel obligated to do everything I possibly can to pass on as few problems as possible to the generations coming behind me, children and grandchildren. I feel very obligated to the generations coming up next. And I'm devastated by the record that my generation has left in this world, particularly around climate crisis. I refuse to call it climate change. It's a climate crisis, a climate emergency. It keeps me up at night all the time now, Libby, and it affects equity, equality, socioeconomic well-being. The climate crisis pervades all of that. And till we dedicate every resource to eliminating the worst effects of the climate crisis. We will not achieve economic equality in this world. We simply will not.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that in your next work or role that you take on, that you're going to be working closely with Indigenous peoples in our city or beyond, because I do think that's also very much a key to the future in terms of truth, understanding, and reconciliation, and the more we participate in that in an active way. So that's really amazing that you're going to continue doing work in that particular area as well. So good on you for that.
I'm really looking forward to working with this particular nation and learning a great deal from them. I will have some of my experience to offer, and I will be learning a great deal from them as well. And it is the future, particularly here in British Columbia, where we have the Declaration Act that everything must be managed with the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People taken into account. And the British Columbia government is very serious about that. And the leadership of the of our Indigenous nations are up to the challenge to holding the government to account in that area. It's what should be, it's what needs to be, and it's exciting.
Absolutely, Joy. Well, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear your upbeat and always super real take on things. Congratulations again on the Order of Canada. When I read it in the paper, I was like, yay, this is so well deserved.
It was a big honor. I was very pleased. Yeah.
It's wonderful and a real recognition. I just got to say, you do us all proud. And what I love is that you're still in that role of mentoring, of participating as we approach our more elderly years. I think, you know, there's a lot of wisdom that you have to share with people. So I thank you so much for taking a little bit of time here today to share with the Rabble community some of the things that have been important to you over your lifetime of work and what you're continuing to do.
Thanks, Lib, and I want to see you in person next time, please.
Absolutely.
Was a conversation between Joy McPhail and Libby Davies. Thanks so much for that, Joy and Libby. If you're interested in hearing more about women in politics, we highly recommend you check out Libby Davies' conversations with Dr. Jeanette Ash, which we hosted at the beginning of the year. In that two-part discussion, Davies and Ash talk about the efforts being made to create a gender-sensitive parliament in Canada. It's definitely worth a listen. Find this and more at rabble.ca/podcasts. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. This week, Rabble.ca continues its coverage of news and analysis on the Russian-Ukraine war. Thomas Woodley says Canadians should be wary of wartime reporting that follows simplistic storytelling principles. That kind of journalism can create momentum or sympathy around an issue as easily as it can cause us to overlook or euphemize issues. While simple narratives of good and evil may work well for fiction, in reporting, it's never that straightforward. Brent Patterson raises concerns about a statement made by NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg calling upon allies to invest in a minimum of 2% of GDP on defense. Currently, Canada uses about 1.39% of our gross domestic product on the military. In 2022 to 2021, that was $23.3 billion. If we were to bring the budget up to 2%, Canada would be spending $41.6 billion per year. The federal budget is expected to be announced in the first week of April, and that's when we might learn if the Trudeau government will move to that 2% threshold and spend another $20 billion a year on the military. To share some recent history, Canada spent at least $18 billion on the war in Afghanistan, and the US spent $2.3 trillion, or about $300 million a day. And now, we are again seemingly being told that more military spending is the answer, Patterson writes. Clear thinking about all of this is needed, especially in the fog of war, and a 2% threshold does not offer that guidance. Monia Mazig examines Canada's vague and purposefully ambiguous position on its citizens joining the fight against Russia in Ukraine. This is an illegal war, Mazig writes, so the Canadian response to such illegality should be to avoid joining a side and instead accept refugees and push for de-escalation and negotiations for peace. We cannot, on one hand, turn a blind eye on those who are fighting with Ukraine and on the other hand, warn persecution on those traveling to fight for Russia. This double standard will not position Canada as an honest and trustworthy international peace broker. Also on the site this week, Stephen Wenzel reports on a piece of legislation currently waiting to be passed by the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia. It will protect student journalists' right to publish, free from censorship. The Student Press Freedom Act was brought to court after two high school students in Vancouver received a threat of censorship from their school district about the content of their high school newspaper. The content in question criticized the school district. The legislation has been backed by the Canadian Association of Journalists. Brent Jolly, president of the CAJ, said in a statement, "Just because a journalist is young and doesn't have the backing of a large news outlet shouldn't preclude them from asking powerful people tough questions and holding them accountable for their actions." Meanwhile, as COVID restrictions let up across the country, Evelyn Lazare argues, "Dealing with COVID-19 is not a black and white issue, and finding a new normal is subject to debate. We are entering the era of antinomic thinking, or the ability to consider two different and opposing concepts at the same time," Lazare writes. "Are we up to this challenge? Can we handle cognitive dissonance on a grand scale? There are two major concepts we have to consider. One is that COVID-19 is likely here to stay. A second and contrary concept we have to accept is that we can now dial down concern about COVID-19. These are complicated issues which we're not only dealing with individually, but also as a society. And no matter how we go about it, learning to live in the messy gray is now required," she concludes. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel for his reporting this week, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at Local 107.3 FM in St. John, New Brunswick this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.